Welcome to Tilth Talk Radio. Today we have a special interview episode. We'll be interviewing UW-Madison NPM Program Manager Dan Smith. And with me are Bill Schomburg.
Hey, guys.
Todd Schomburg.
Hey to all the Tilthies out there.
And I'm Matt Brueger, all with Tilth Agronomy. All right, we didn't get much rain this last batch here, but hopefully we'll get something going here.
Zero.
So today we're talking to Dan Smith with UW-Madison NPM Program Manager down there. So Dan, how's things down there? Is it a little wetter after yesterday in your neck of the woods?
Yeah, absolutely. So we were lucky that we did get some precipitation, anywhere from a half to a full inch of rain. And I hope that continues for all the farmers in southern Wisconsin, and hope that the rest of the state sees some good rainfalls as well. Surprisingly, we saw some alfalfa get planted last week, so everybody's kind of itching to get to the field. I know we've had phenomenal conditions in southern Wisconsin. It was 66 again yesterday, so some really good field conditions. I've actually heard that the cereal rye fields are actually a little bit too wet yet. We've been doing a lot of work southern Wisconsin planting alfalfa into cereal rye, and they're kind of retaining a lot of moisture yet, so that's good news for those guys, and hopefully we continue to see conditions improve.
Yeah, I was down in Ripon yesterday. It was the furthest south I made it, but the cereal rye down there looks way different than it does up here. Everything's looks like it's waking up. It's green. Here we're getting a little bit of that in the northeast, but we're not quite at that same level yet. So
I went by a field that was probably planted after silage corn yesterday, and I would say there was probably 4 to 6 inches of growth out there already, which I was shocked.
Yeah, wow.
That is shocking to get that much growth already.
In Greene County, though, so our farthest south end of the state. But
it is March 15th, though. I mean, that is crazy. I mean, we had snow on the ground last year at this point, so that is nuts. And I would agree with you, Dan. I was talking to a farmer yesterday that was fertilizing some pastures, and we were talking about, are we going to do the rye or not? And he walked out in the field and he said, it's still wet. Like, I totally agree with that retaining. We need some more action, right? We need some more activity of that plant to start sucking moisture.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's growing. Once the temperatures hit, 45, 50 degrees, it's started to grow really well. So we're going to see, I think, a tremendous amount of biomass this spring, which could be a challenge, or could be a really good thing, could really help us throughout the growing season if it does stay just a touch dry.
Yeah, it's been interesting. Everybody's, like we said, kind of jumpy, wants to get out in the field. We've got guys talking wheat fertilization, new seedings, and even cover crop-wise, I've heard guys saying, well, depending on what the weather does, if we get wet or not, we might be considering early termination this year just because there is going to be so much biomass out there.
Yeah. And that would be a much different mindset than what we were in last year, where we're thinking about, we needed to terminate as soon as we could, just because it got so dry in the fields that we didn't terminate early. Maybe we're a little bit challenged when we planted corn into those. So this year, now the mindset, we might be a little bit wet and need to take those out a little bit early too, is interesting. We only get so many growing seasons, so it's tough to make the best decision every time. So I hope we can have a little bit of normal weather to help make those decisions.
Yeah, I wish we knew what normal was anymore. But
right.
So along with your duties at UW-Madison Division of Extension, you're also a member of the Wisconsin CCA Board. So I guess that kind of makes you our boss a little bit, right?
Absolutely not. You guys are no.
I just saw an email last week. They were looking, the elections must have just been up for some board members, and they're looking for a handful of seats. So hopefully those were filled, and maybe we'll have to consider that, guys, next year if they're looking again.
Yeah, we're going to be. I think that things kind of aligned with COVID, and they had some seats kind of get stacked up. So about 4 years ago, the terms are starting to term out now, and needed quite a few good candidates, and we've got some good ones, but if you guys are interested or anyone else is, I encourage you to apply. We got about 24 hours as we're taping today to get those applications in, but certainly appreciate everyone that's applied so far.
So what do you find is the most active thing you have to do as a CCA board member? Is it just kind of going through the CCA exams every year and making sure the questions make sense, or what does it all entail?
So I'm a little bit different than an elected CCA board member. From my own experience, I represent the University of Wisconsin on the board, and I'm kind of the impartial individual that helps just lead the elections. And then the CCA board provides a lot of feedback to our program about publications and kind of outreach direction. So very thankful for that collaboration. A typical CCA board member would attend 3 meetings a year, and they would vote on topics such as exam date. They could serve on the exam committee. They could serve on the ethics committee, which would deal with any possible complaints that would come in about other CCAs violating our code of ethics that we all sign. And then we also have members that go to Corn Soy Expo to represent the organization, or the WAVA Classic, those type of things. I think it's a great way to interact and network with CCAs across the state. A really phenomenal opportunity to learn what other CCAs are doing and meet people that work in other cropping systems. So it's a cool volunteer opportunity.
Yeah, sounds like it. I know I've met a couple of the members of the board over the years, but I've never seen all of them together at once, I don't think, other than the Breakfast of the Classic. Sometimes there's some of the board members are there. And
what is cool about the CCA Certified Crop Advisor is it's worldwide program, right, Dan? But it's based here in Madison. The whole nationwide group is based in Madison. Do I have that correct?
Correct, yeah. So the American Society of Agronomy and Crop Science Society of America and the Soil Science Society of America is all based in Madison, Wisconsin. They have a team there. Each state has a representative for their CCA program that kind of leads that. I'm sure they work on multiple states, the staff that do, but we all have assigned staff. And a very much so worldwide program. Their conference I attended last year, I presented some research at, and there was over 4,400 attendees in St. Louis for that meeting. Really? From everywhere.
Wow.
So certainly a good group to get tied into.
Do you consider them societies? Are they very high society? Like, is it, what kind of meeting?
Do you have to wear
this?
Wigs and, yes, like fancy outfits when you go to this?
Well, I was told I couldn't wear my jeans, but
very fine that, in the high society.
There was a lot of crop advisors from across the country attended that, and a lot of researchers. Mostly researchers attend the annual meeting, of course, but they do offer CCA credits. So,
yeah, very cool. All right, I think the meat of what we're looking to talk about is cover crops. We touched on it a little bit before. What's your experience with cover crops? What have you seen work as far as easiest to establish cover crops in our dairy system?
Yeah, so I'll use two pools of data that I've had the opportunity to work on. And one is a lot of the research trials that we've had that are systems-based at the Arlington and Lancaster Research Station. And we won't talk a lot about yield today because we know that we're talking to producers possibly in the northeast part of the state, but maybe even statewide. But what I will say that we've learned from those research trials of planting corn and soybean into rye for the last 6 seasons is you can't mess up soybeans. Planting soybeans into rye that's been terminated 2 weeks before planting, terminated the same day as planting, taking rylage off, or waiting 2 weeks after, the soybeans don't care. The yields don't care. They really don't respond to that biomass. What we've seen in corn can be really tricky. We've started an additional trial where we're looking at corn nitrogen rates after winter rye, where we're planting corn into winter rye residue and terminating the same day as planting. We really feel that rye should be terminated at planting or before for corn based on all the work we've done. Otherwise, you just get really uneven stand. We're not doing anything fancy with our corn planter either, but we have maintained it. We are ensuring that we're closing the furrow and planting to the appropriate depth. So that's really important to take home. So we're not worried about stand establishment. But last year when it was so dry, there were some pockets of moisture that made planting depth really challenging. So we actually were thinking that we should have maybe even planted deeper. Moving in further into that dairy system, planting corn after rylage, we haven't seen any problems when we chop the rylage and plant corn the same day until last year. And last year we had a lot of uneven stand issues. And I think that's because of those soil moisture challenges where we'd hit pockets of moisture, and then we'd move out of that pocket of moisture and the corn would sit in the ground for a couple weeks. I will say that we still did make some pretty decent corn silage off those fields. So I wasn't as nervous as I thought, but boy, in June, I got a lot of phone calls that were negative, and rightfully so, because those were challenging environments. And I'm sure you guys did too. Some challenging environments for the corn plant to hang out in. And of course, we had the wildfire smoke last year too, that really probably suppressed crop growth and helped us out, kept temperatures a little bit cooler. But at the same time, those are some really challenging fields to look at for the month. So that was tough news. We've also been doing a statewide cover crop survey where we're looking at beyond rye. We're looking at the mixes. We're looking at all the cool stuff that Wisconsin farmers are innovating and working on. And what we found is rye is the most common cover crop after all these different systems. So after wheat, after corn silage, after corn grain and soybeans, and after vegetable crops. But we get a little bit more window after wheat and after corn silage to do some cool stuff, to put in some mixes, depending on where you're at in the state. Put in maybe half of a mix of oats, half a mix of rye. That way you don't have all that biomass over winter, but we still hold the soil in place, hold some manure in the landscape, that type of thing. So those are some of the exciting things that I've been able to work on and look at, certainly collaborate with farmers across the state, and really interested in seeing how we can move that needle of cover crop adoption. What are the things that we need to research? What are the things that are missing to help fill in those gaps? Time is always a critical component whenever we talk to farmers. That's something that we can't replace, but maybe we can give them back some time in the spring with not having to spray everything three times or work the ground up, that type of thing.
Sure. Dan, did those farmers in that survey have the ability to say why rye? Or is it just easy? Like, rye's easy, so we're going to do it. I mean, did they have an opportunity to give you an opinion in that way?
Yeah, they did. So rye, cost was there. The fact that it's always going to overwinter. And the fact that they can reliably produce biomass for either feed or just soil erosion control were the two main components.
It's just a tough SOB.
It is.
Yeah.
Rye is resilient, almost too resilient at times, yes.
And we saw the same thing, Dan, with planting into, you know, we left our covers go because it was wet and we made those decisions. Like, we need those plants to start sucking moisture, and then the pendulum almost just changed to the exact opposite, and it just kicked our butt with almost the opposite, where it took out two and then took out too much moisture, and then we had the same issues with poor emergence and looking at those fields in May and June and July going, we're gonna have to buy feed here, like we really don't have enough corn. And then August just went, whoa, like boom, and it flipped, and we had enough yield. So that was neat to see that it was so resilient.
We didn't see any rainfall from May 6th until the 4th of July. And that made things look incredibly challenging with those rye systems. And very near where I live, there's a farmer that produces a lot of corn silage following a cover crop mix. And they chopped their corn. And unfortunately, they got a little bit of corn silage in my lawn. And I didn't care. It was, you know, I work in ag too, so I don't care. I'll just mow it up. But they called me, apologized. I live in an area where people are somewhat worried about that.
How much corn silage are you talking? Because sometimes it can just be like, you know, like a little bit, like a small garbage can full. But sometimes it can be like this.
Half the wagon?
Yeah, right. Like a size of a four-wheeler pile.
I think they came back with a bobcat. So it was, it was a little,
so it was enough. Yeah. They wanted it. They actually probably wanted it back at that point. Yeah.
But he called me when he was in the chopper, I think on the Bluetooth, driving back home, and 8 o'clock at night, and he says, yeah, I'm gonna be over there tomorrow with the drill. And I said, gosh, I don't know if I would do that. This was last year when it was dry. It was still dry when he chopped the corn. And I said, gosh, I just don't know, like, this was a challenging year for cover crops. We walked a lot of fields, we talked a lot. I said, where's your mindset coming from? He says, I know it works. I know that I can reliably plant a crop into the biomass. I know that I can use the biomass for feed. He says, I want to continue on the system. I want to continue building the soil health. I want to continue having that reliable amount of biomass to feed my cattle in the spring then. And I thought, you know, that's great. I said, I don't know if I have the stomach for that again after this year. So it's very encouraging and helped me a lot.
How's that field look today then?
It looks beautiful. It's nice and green today. I almost worry that we saw some oats over winter, but not to freak anybody out, I haven't confirmed that. But I will say that field stayed green all year. It did not die back in the wintertime. We just did not get cold enough.
I thought that was that's a good observation, Dan, is how green everything stayed, all of, you know, especially rye, but barley, wheat, oats,
my lawn.
Yeah, everything just stayed green all winter. It never really seemed to go dormant. What did you see on the sort of dormancy front, both with alfalfa and maybe wheat and talking cover crops too?
Yeah, the alfalfa fields I've been keeping an eye on this winter, certainly I think are going to thrive this spring because they did not die back nearly as hard as they usually would have. We got one big snowfall that was over about 24 hours. I think we got about 16 or 17 inches. I guess that was probably mid-January before we got the snow. We did get a little bit cold, but nothing below zero. And then after the snow, we got cold, but we were so well insulated, the ground really never froze. We've been keeping an eye on the ground for a couple projects out in my woods, and the ground here in southern Wisconsin never froze significantly. So good year for alfalfa, good year for the forage crops. I got an email last week about someone concerned that their turnips overwintered. I haven't confirmed that yet either out in the field, but I'm not surprised because our conditions just really didn't get that cold. My grass is green in my lawn. It's weird. I've got the snow blade still on the tractor, but thinking, gosh, if it continues to be 60 degrees during the day, I'm going to put the mower deck on. So weird spring.
Dan, the three of us were headed to San Antonio for NAICC, the National Crop Consultant Convention, on the coldest day of the year. That was right in that time frame you had said, January 16th or something like that. And we had just had the same snowstorm up here. So our alfalfa fields got that 15 inches of snow and then it got cold. So I think we're in the same boat. I'm not worried too much about our alfalfa because when it was cold, it was covered.
Now, we've been using the term winter because that's normally what this season is, but we had about a week of winter and really the rest has been fall or spring, depending on how you want to call it. Just temperature wise, we've been sitting above normal, and then when we drop down, it's only for a day or two. So the impact it's having is pretty minimal on a lot of these cover crops and alfalfa fields. And so it's kind of interesting to see a year like that where, like you said, we may have things over winter, in quotation marks there, because we never really had that real cold snap to kind of set everything, either kill the overwintering species or the non-overwintering species, I should say, and just everything, it kept growing.
Right. I always look forward to that first, 28-degree day to see what that takes out in the cover crop mixed fields after wheat, where we have really diverse species, and I always look forward to the next time of when it gets down to, 22, because that usually takes everything else out. I just really never saw that significant timing where it killed all the cover crops right away. I think it was very slow and gradual throughout the winter. I did some videos out in that oat rye field in late November, and things were still growing. The amount of biomass produced after silage corn this year, I think, is going to be a record. And I think people should be really encouraged by that, to have that biomass out in the landscape this year, especially since it's retaining so much moisture. I think it's going to be an interesting year for insects, too. I'm certainly not an entomologist by training, but I've heard that ticks are already out in southern Wisconsin.
No way.
I've heard the same.
Weird. I think the populations didn't have the opportunity to get killed off. So hopefully we don't see anything really weird. I know that we're going to spend a lot of time monitoring and trapping for fall armyworm, and seeing where that population goes, because that's caused us some real grief the last 2 years. So
look for variegated cutworm like 2012.
Yep.
Yeah.
Now, we've had the same, talking to some guys that have woods and do maple syrup and all that kind of stuff. Is I've heard even up here ticks are active. And it's just not something you expect in February, March to have to worry about checking yourself for ticks.
No, gross. That's just gross. That's why we live in Wisconsin. And so
that's where I live, where my face hurts.
Right. So we get a break from all that.
Just to go back a little bit, you had talked about planting into corn and the issues there. I don't know if you guys are part of this research project. I don't remember in the presentation I saw, but back in December, I was at a conference in Minnesota, and there was a research project of Iowa State looking at Pythium and Fusarium populations in rye fields affecting corn. Is that similar to what the research that you guys have been doing? And are you seeing the Pythium being the part of the issue with corn?
We have not actually spent any time on that, and I'm not aware of any work that in Wisconsin on that. I'd actually be interested in looking up that research from Iowa just to see what they're seeing. on the disease field, the only thing that we've done, we spent some time looking at white mold suppression with winter rye.
Okay.
But we did not spend any time in corn. So something for us to continue to work on.
Does white mold not care like beans, Dan, or does white mold care if rye is there?
White mold is suppressed by the rye. Unfortunately, I don't have any data from our trials. We're relying on other researchers' work to indicate that. And the reason why I say we didn't have any is because we didn't have the conditions for white mold the 2 years we spent working on it across the state. But certainly the research does show that it is suppressed by it. The little mushroom-like spores are suppressed by the residue.
That's interesting. Especially with how much guys, you know, we worry about white mold. And like you said, Dan, it's hard to predict when white mold will be a problem. I know we've got more apps and stuff to help predict that, but anything to suppress it would be great, especially on some of these fields where we know we've got a problem with it. So,
yeah, some very encouraging work. And it's another tool in the toolbox. So we can suppress our diseases a little bit and we can suppress our weeds a little bit. And help recover that cost of that cover crop.
Well, we're talking beans. Earlier you said beans don't care about the rye. I like that. Can you get into any more specifics on that? Did you literally see all the time, like every time it works? Was there any sort of maybe a little bit of spot where it might care? Or was it literally just, you know, beans are very good with a sort of a rye cover crop, I think you were specific to. So.
Yeah, so we've been planting soybeans into rye residue for the last six seasons. And we planted, we did some comparisons where we did a full till, where we did fall chiseled corn stalks and finished the residue in the spring with a field finisher. No-till soybeans. And then we're comparing that to soybeans that we're planting 2 weeks after rye is terminated. So that used to be the old crop insurance guidelines for us, was we'd have to terminate 10 days to 2 weeks beforehand to meet crop insurance guidelines. The rules have changed now. Any good agronomist can make a recommendation. You guys can make a recommendation to say, hey, this is what I feel locally works well. And always talk to your crop insurance advisor about all the details. And then we're also planting green. So we're planting right into the residue. It's usually about knee high when we're actually planting our soybeans. We are planting a little bit later than what the university recommends because we're trying for biomass. So in weed science, we're trying to get to the most amount of biomass. Yield is incredibly important, but we've been able to preserve yield planting a little bit later. We're not winning yield contests by any means. They're not going to be the 80 to 90 bushel soybeans, but we have grown 75 bushel soybeans in the system very readily and very consistently. And then we're also terminating the rye 2 weeks after planting, and we're also cutting rylage plots. So we've got those six comparisons out in the field. The yields have been statistically the same every year except for last year. We saw a little bit of a yield drag at Lancaster last year because how dry it was, and we can contribute that to environmental conditions. And last year's an outlier for our data set. So across all those different treatments, the soybeans have not yielded differently at Arlington and Lancaster. Don't worry about the location, team. Those research results seem to be holding up wherever we see data come back. Soybeans just early on when they're competing with that rye residue, they're not thinking about yield like corn is already. It's just they're not too focused on that. And the rye residue is holding everything else back. So when we look at the hierarchy of different things that compete for yield, the rye residue is maybe competing for a little bit of moisture. But again, soybeans don't need a ton of moisture at that time of their growth cycle. And they don't need much soil fertility either. So there's just not much competition factor. Now, I have seen instances where we have a lot of contour strips in southern Wisconsin. Things get unfortunately forgotten. I've seen a few isolated cases where rye and soybeans have been allowed to grow for like 2-3 weeks into June. And those fields are tough. What's really interesting, though, is that's really high quality forage. And I talked to my grandpa and he used to use soybeans for forage. So those are kind of opportunities for us to research and think about of using some low cost soybeans and planting rye with those and growing kind of a unique forage mix for mid-June. But in those cases, I would expect yield to be hurt. Cases where we forgot to come back and terminate the rye in those small fields. But roller crimping has also been really proven as well. And that's where we think about comparison to this amount of biomass that we're producing. In the weed science world, we'd like to get to 4,000, 4,500 pounds of biomass, which on me is going to be at least waist high or so. And that's going to be a pretty dense mat planted at about a bushel per acre. That residue takes some management challenges with the planter. We can't just drive into that field and plant soybeans, because what we found is the furrows difficult to close, and it's difficult to get enough depth out of the gauge wheels to plant those soybeans into the ground. And in those cases, we have seen yield drags, and we have seen yields being wiped out entirely because of planter issues, not because of the rye residue competing later on, but we just didn't get a stand. So that's been something that we're thinking more about too, is just making sure that we can communicate to everybody that what we're doing is very unique. It does take a little bit different approach, but it can be done, and we're not seeing any negative effects of that. As long as we take the time to get out of the tractor cab, look at the planter a couple times in a very small area to get things set up. Also, it's not something I'd recommend doing right away. If you're going to plant soybeans this spring into rye residue, spray them off the same day that you plant the rye residue. I like planting into green growing residue. I feel like the soil conditions are prime in that environment. Spraying things off 2 weeks beforehand planting, I think it's a little bit tougher to plant into that environment. Everybody says, well, there's a interaction with the roots and the plant and everything. And what it comes down to is it's just the soil is open, and it was so moist that it gets hit with a lot of sun. It absorbs a lot of energy, and it just dries out, and it gets really hard then compacted, as you guys have seen that on the field. So that's why I really like planting into a living cover crop, no matter corn or soybeans, but being really mindful with corn and getting out there with the sprayer conditions. This is really a kind of a little bit more of an advanced agronomy topic compared to just going out and working up the field. You have 3-4 days to go out and plant after you worked it up. You can come back and spray it with your pre-emerge, maybe even up to a week if you're not, you know, using a corn herbicide, soybean herbicide. A lot of those we have to apply, of course, at planting or before they spike. But with the corn moving into the winter rye, we just have to have a plan, because the rye is going to continue to grow, and sometimes quite rapidly. We see maybe an inch of growth, if not more, in the early spring. When we see those 60, 70 degree days, the rye takes off. So we just have to have a plan.
I like that, Dan, because I think sometimes we group these cover crops together and don't think of the next crop. And like you say, if the next crop beans don't care. I like that. I don't know if has Sean Conley tried to patent that already or not, like cool beans don't care, something like that.
Not yet. All right. Yeah. I know that I'm sure he's going to, so right. I haven't got my cool bean tattoo yet. So
yeah. What have you seen as far as, have you seen much difference in planting rate when planting green? I know we've been ratcheting that down over the years of you don't need as much biomass there when you're planting green. You can still get pretty good suppression without, you know, I mean, 10 years ago we were probably planting 100 pounds of rye out there, and we haven't been doing that anymore. What have you seen as kind of the sweet spot for that rate?
Yeah, unfortunately, Matt, we're stuck in 2018 because we designed a long-term study. So we set our planting rate for the rye and for the soybeans in 2018. So we're at 140,000 for the soybeans, and we're at a bushel per acre for the rye. Today, if you'd ask me that same question, I would say, well, gosh, maybe we start at like 20 pounds for rye, and we go down to Dr. Conley's recommendations for soybeans. We drop those populations a little bit more. I don't think you could go wrong in that system. Less biomass is not going to hurt anything, besides maybe a little bit less weed suppression later on in the season, because we do see those light residue amounts breaking down really quickly in the spring. So we see that rye kind of just being erased by, say, 4th of July. In those plots where we have 4,000 pounds of rye, you can still see quite a bit of biomass the following spring and even the following summer. So we're getting almost 2 years out of that straw.
Sure.
Very high carbon to nitrogen ratio out of that much biomass, though, too. So yeah, I agree. Let's drop the seeding rates down this year. 20 pounds per acre of rye, I think you're going to be really happy with that. And it's going to save some costs. It's going to save some planting time. And you're going to get a decent amount of biomass to plant into. You're not going to have that tremendous amount to manage either the next year.
Dan, is there any traction at UW about, I guess I'm a little bit concerned with all this residue we put on the surface and then we come through with herbicides. Any traction or talk at UW about that herbicide not actually getting to the soil, where maybe we need to increase rates or anything of that nature? Now you're talking about rye, you know, suppressing weeds, so maybe it's not a concern, but I'm nervous at some point in corn and beans that we're going through all this residue and some of this herbicide that needs to get to the soil is not. Any talk there?
Yeah, you're right. So the rye residue is intercepting the herbicides. Now, what we've also seen somewhat is that rye residue is able to have the herbicide washed off and move into the soil surface and still suppress weeds. But we've got some really exciting stuff that was just presented yesterday by Dr. Josette Nunez, brand new PhD candidate yesterday. He was confirmed and is going to be publishing that in Extension World for us as well, hopefully very soon, to talk about that very factor. 2 years of work where they're using the droplet cards to measure how much herbicide is actually getting through the rye residue with various herbicide mixes. So we'll have that data primarily in soybeans. Soybeans, there's a lot of push to incorporate cover crops really nationwide. So there's a lot of research projects, a lot of research funding to look at those topics. So yeah, really soon we're going to have the data to tell you exactly what's going on the field. That work is all wrapped up and written up.
Still secret.
I'm just not an expert at that, and I don't want to steal any of his thunder either. So like I said, just yesterday he presented on that. So we'll see that out in the Extension World soon.
Fair enough.
Have you guys done much with, I know we've had some farms for the harvest side of cover crops looking at triticale for both heifer feed and even dairy quality feed. Has there been much work done on that down by you guys or?
No, not as much. And I don't know why. I've stuck with rye, and maybe that's one of the reasons why, is just, you know, the preference of sticking with something for a while and keeping to that. I know triticale is very popular on farms in southern Wisconsin. A lot of guys are planting that for forage. Certainly for the cover crop, I get about one question every fall about rye versus triticale. Should I go with the triticale over the rye? But I don't see a lot of it in our research studies for whatever reason. Something for us to dig into maybe a little bit more. I have heard that you might get a little bit different tillering out of the different varieties of triticale versus rye too, which would be really interesting from the weed suppression standpoint of, can you get a little bit more biomass a little bit earlier?
Sure.
We're also seeing a push towards wheat as the cover crop. Dan, are you, what kind of research have you seen, the benefits over rye or maybe the negatives? And are you seeing that kind of swing towards, like you said in your survey earlier, rye was king and dominant in the cover crop world. But what do you think will be the next thing to kind of dethrone it or at least maybe become the queen or this in sort of second place?
Yeah. If I had to guess today, I would say that red clover or oats are going to be the one that could overthrow it possibly. And just because if we look at some of the new funding for climate smart ag practices, it's going to push everyone to plant a cover crop. And when I say everyone, I think it could be, you know, we could see a third or two thirds of the acres in the Corn Belt covered in a cover crop if everything comes true. I'm not going to bet on that today, but when we think about the number of acres being planted, that could drive up rye price substantially. And it could also really dry out the current supply of rye. Right now, rye seed sells out when we try and buy seed. Certain varieties of seed, we've got to order that in July, August right now. And we're cover cropping maybe 20% of Wisconsin at the most. I don't have the ag stats just came out last week. I don't remember what they said, but I know it wasn't that big of a percentage. Moving forward with some of these new federal programs, we start cover cropping double or triple the acres, we're going to start looking at the other species. So I would immediately go to oats after wheat or after silage corn, let the volunteer wheat continue to grow, of course, in that environment. And then red clover, I've always liked for interseeding. I always liked red clover frost-seeded into wheat, that type of thing. Moving back to the wheat question, with we've seen more wheat, I think we are because of the cost factor. So maybe a little bit of bin run wheat. It's going to grow well. Possibly just we have leftover wheat. We're going to plant the leftover wheat out in the field and get rid of it. We certainly in the survey, we do see some farms that are planting wheat or letting the volunteer wheat come back after wheat harvest. Cheap cover crop, why not use it? There's was such a push when I was doing the work in wheat. I did some herbicide carryover work in wheat probably about 7-8 years ago now, or a little bit more even. And there was a huge push to make sure that we killed the wheat in the fall, that it was just tough to kill in the spring. I never saw that, but we think back to glyphosate activity on grasses. If we're spraying glyphosate, say today, it's not going to kill anything because it just got too cool last night. We really need that translocation to happen. And I think that was the biggest problem with the overwintering wheat was we wanted to maintain planting date for corn and soybeans really early. So we were trying to go out and spray that wheat off in early April, and it was just too cool for the herbicide translocate. Go out and spray the wheat in an actively growing environment where we're 50 degrees during the day, 60 degrees during 50 degrees during the night, 60 degrees during the day, actively growing conditions, you're not going to see a problem. So
I think it's interesting with the wheat side of things, because it is less biomass. Wheat doesn't get as tall as rye. And I know I've had a farm that's been doing that for years. And like you said, Dan, it is the cost factor of I'll just take some, you know, keep gravity box of wheat from my field, and that's what I use to plant my cover crop, and then I'll let the volunteer grow too, so then I can go a lower rate and just kind of let everything come up. And so far it's worked out for him pretty well. But yeah, you just don't see as much biomass as quickly. So it does give you kind of a better planting window. You don't have to worry about getting quite as out of control like rye can do. But yeah, if you're looking for weed suppression, you're probably not getting as much of a mat there after termination. So it's definitely a trade-off, I think, from what rye, and one of the reasons rye is king, especially with the weed suppressive qualities.
Certainly still some good opportunities to apply manure into that residue and have that nutrient being held into place by that wheat root and that wheat biomass. I think wheat could get really popular too. Because of that seed availability factor, we've spent some time talking to guys about saving cover crop seed. I'm certainly an advocate for buying new seed every year, only because I think it's a little bit challenging to store cover crop seed if you don't have a plan already in place. But that could be the future too, as we're starting to legally plant cover crops that we can save for seed. Having a gravity box full of them, you look at the math and you grow 5-6 acres of wheat or rye, you've got a lot of seed to plant then across a large amount of acres if at a 10-15 pound seeding rate for a cover crop use. So that could be a way to avoid some of these future costs too. But we'll see where things go. I think it's a really exciting time to be working in this space. We get nationwide interest for questions and comments, and I get a lot of emails, a lot of comments from Wisconsin farmers thinking about some of these innovative techniques we've talked about so far about, hey, yesterday was sugar beets. Somebody was interested in planting sugar beets for various reasons instead of turnips or radishes. And we had a really cool discussion talking about that. I have some reservations about that. I don't think that it's going to be nearly as exciting as it could be, but there are some really cool actual vegetable crops we grow in our gardens that people are planting as cover crops now because they're seeing some value to it. They're seeing some interest, but primarily after wheat for stuff like that. That's where our innovation is going to happen. We're going to be stuck with those small grains after corn and soybean.
Dan, you had mentioned oats earlier. And sometimes we try to pick a cover crop that's king or the best, but sometimes it's nice just pitting two against each other. One of my kids is into these versus books where I don't even think these animals see each other in nature, but they got these books where they put like a polar bear versus a grizzly bear, and you read the book and which one would win. So my question for you, Dan, is oats versus barley. Now, why did you pick oats over barley, and what are some of the benefits and what if you had to pit those two against each other, which one would win in that case?
Yeah, I think it's the familiarity with oats, with oat management, with oat growth. The historical presence of oats on the landscape has been quite great, of course, because of our alfalfa seeding mixes. That's where I come back to with oats. I think they do put on a little bit more biomass maybe after a later seeding in silage corn systems. I was surprised at how much biomass we got out of oats last year. Normally, I think, well, gosh, I'm just not going to see that much biomass happen. We can see anything from, 2 to 6 inches of biomass out of oats after silage corn if we have good growing conditions. If we're chopping October 1, don't plant oats, is my opinion. Oats versus barley, going back to that, I don't know. Again, I've done some aerial seeding, simulated aerial seeding of barley versus oats, and I've seen some similar growth, but just, of course, they're not going to overwinter, but I don't know why we arrived at that. I think barley is a cool crop. I think it's something that certainly we should be working more on incorporating into the rotation. Maybe there's a cost factor that I'm not aware of too. Availability factor. I know I can get oats really easily. I'm sure I can get barley too. A few years ago, we did some crazy stuff and we looked at frost seeding oats and barley in the spring to see how things would go. Unfortunately, I know that research did not continue because they actually vernalized the rye. It got cold enough where the rye did set seed too, where that was the goal, was primarily trying to miss that window. So that's some of the sort of cool stuff that you could think about doing with those other small grains, is opening up that window in the spring too, because you're just not going to see them take off like rye does. What do you guys like for oats versus barley?
I think that was a good answer. What you said, and I almost agree to it, is I think we look too much in Trident to compare them, and they're both fine. They maybe have a little bit more unique times where they're a little different, but in general, we're talking about a pretty similar bag here of stuff, you know, that you're not getting something way different from either one. So, and we've talked as a group, and Matt knows my opinion. This is, I think guys overthink the mixes sometimes, or try to find out like something really cool and new that's going to, and I'm sure there will be something cool and new, and hopefully we do find that, but there's still these good old standbys, like you said. I liked what you said about oats being familiar. We're used to growing oats. I think wheat kind of falls in that same category of we're used to growing it. And then it comes down to price and what can we get the cheapest out there. And a lot of times that is oats and wheat. So how you manage around that, I think, will be interesting. I think you also made a good interesting point of, in the future, as these seeds, there's more demand for them and the price increases, that may change what you plant as well. So yeah, I what do you guys think on that?
Well, we did a plot on a farm that I work with, and it was a forage plot this last fall. So they had harvested rye, planted a forage plot, and half of the plot was just barley and just oats, and at different rates. So I think he had 50, 100, 150 of barley, and 100, 150, and 200 of oats. And I was surprised when he came to harvest it in October, the barley was headed out and the oats was just a little bit behind. So we got the quicker growth of the barley, gave us pretty comparable biomass actually in the end. Like when we took samples of each section of the field, it was really close as far as biomass, even feed quality was pretty close. So it was like a neck and neck run, other than just that little bit of extra maturity out of the barley we could have probably harvested earlier and improved the quality slightly. But yeah, it was neck and neck. So yeah, there isn't, like you said, I don't think it's worth overthinking. I think they're both pretty good options, whether it's looking for an after wheat or rye fall forage or a cover crop, that you're going to get pretty similar growth out of each.
We're just familiar with oats, right? Like this state.
Yeah.
I mean, peas and oats, like you said, Daniel, and seedings. And heck, Todd and my grandpa used to combine oats back in the 80s and early 90s. And
I remember him coming, he had a, you know, that open cab gleaner combine, and it was so dusty that he'd just come back and he'd just be black from all the dust out there. And just, yeah, and I don't remember what they fed the oats, I'm
assuming.
Yeah,
the oats went in the granary.
Right.
You know, and you fed them for calf feed, probably. And
you just, like you say, we're very familiar with that.
It'll be interesting to see where things go in the next couple of years with fall forages, too. There's a lot of work on alternative forages where we're planting those late summer and getting tremendous amount of biomass. Like Bill said, about the amount of biomass from the oats and barley is pretty cool to see in the fall. I think that those are outstanding feed sources. Obviously, we're removing some nutrients from the field when we choose to harvest our cover crops, and there's some herbicide rotational restrictions we should be mindful of too, but some good feed in years where we need that feed, we can see some feed, high quality feed, as Matt said, when we test those biomasses in the fall. It's surprising how close they are to alfalfa. Not the same tonnage, not the same feed by any means, but really high quality.
Yeah, no. There's a reason we used to do a lot of oats, because we saw the benefit there, even mixed in with our hay forages. You know, the peas and oats thing is, we've still got some farms that do it mm-hmm. today. I mean, it may not be as common as it used to be, but it's still for some farms a standby. So, yeah, I guess one thing I've always noticed about cover crops and this the debate of different species is, you know, the timing. And we mentioned once you're after corn silage, you're fairly limited to cereals, but wheat is just that great opportunity. Like Dan, I think you mentioned experimenting with, and have you guys in your plots and stuff, have you done much mixtures after wheat, looking at like nitrogen crediting or any of that kind of thing with clovers and different legumes in the mix?
Yeah. So we always plant things individually at the university, which is weird when we show our results to clientele. But we do that so we can measure the impacts of that individual species. And we want each species in a mix to stand up and perform to a goal that we set for it. So we've looked at Verseme clover, crimson clover, red clover, oats, peas, radish, turnip, most of the common cover crops that you'd see planted after wheat, I've seen plots of, or I've planted them myself even. Nitrogen credit wise, unfortunately, we just don't see enough growth out of those plants to have a substantial amount of nitrogen fixed. Now, if we frost seed a red clover into wheat, we can see 40 to 80 pounds of nitrogen reliably. And when we do our research, we wanted to be able to say 95% of the time, this is what's going to happen. So I'm not going to say that legume plant planted after wheat that does get 2 feet tall, say a Verseme clover, didn't fix any nitrogen at all. It certainly did. It certainly did host rhizobia bacteria on the roots, and those rhizobia bacteria certainly did fix some nitrogen back into the soil. Now, the cover crop mix needed nitrogen too to survive and thrive, so it probably used up the nitrogen, and we really shouldn't be crediting anything reliably. But that's certainly an area where I'm committed to doing more work. The research project that I'm part of, we're measuring the nitrogen content in the above ground biomass in the spring and the fall to hopefully provide some recommendations one day. It's going to take a lot of data, but to say, hey, if you have this much amount of nitrogen in the biomass, and we are seeing some significant values there of inorganic nitrogen in the biomass above ground, it's going to be released. It's going to break down, cycle back into the system, and hopefully some of it's going to be planted available the next growing season. But just too early to say. All the research that's been done so far is going to say that we don't have a nitrogen credit after those cover crops grown after just wheat. Some work out of some of the other states on vetch shows a little bit more promising data than what I've seen. Vetch, I've always been a little bit shy on, but they are breeding the hard seed out of it. So it's going to be a little bit better to plant, a little bit better to manage. I haven't seen the wrapping of the tendril effect on the planter as bad as what I've seen some pictures online of either. But certainly something that I think is going to continue to improve. Could be the next system we look at too, is planting like vetch after wheat and then planting corn back into that system, maybe where we really reduce our nitrogen. It seems like of all the different systems, we're going to be really pressed hard in our ethanol markets to reduce nitrogen inputs on corn. So we'll see if using cover crops changes things in that environment. I think it's a little too new to tell where that all goes, but those are all some of the cool things that we're hearing out of the high states of what's to come.
Sure. I think we're getting down on time here, so we did want to mention one thing, and I believe you worked with a friend of our podcast, someone we've had on here before, Kevin Jarek, in the past on some of the combine cleaning clinics thing that you have done. So is that something you're still doing? I know it's important. I think we all think it's important to make sure you're cleaning your equipment to keep that weed seeds and everything else away from being transferred to new fields. But what can you say on that?
Yeah, the combine cleaning thing was something that I didn't know would take me as far as it did in my career so far. It's a really cool project. Kevin and I did a video quite a few years ago, and we just actually got interviewed this last year by one of the big ag media companies on combine cleaning. But
Dan, I feel like you've become like the go-to guy on combine cleaning in Wisconsin somehow, without you even probably knowing you did or wanting to do that. I don't know.
That's the really strange part about combine cleaning, Todd, is I didn't try to become that person, but I've gotten to be part of a few interviews too, and they get posted, I know, online and some of the social media platforms, and reading through some of the comments, some of the news articles similar will get like two or three comments, an article on combine cleaning gets 400 or 500. It's because you know the article says clean a combine in 30 minutes, and everybody says, well, that's doesn't work, which it doesn't. You can clean a combine in 30 minutes, but you can for weed seeds. So we focused a lot on combine cleaning, primarily taking all the weed seeds off the platform or the corn head, dumping out the rock trap, cleaning out the feeder house if you're taking off the head. That's going to clean the majority of the weed seeds out. Some of the weed seeds do get, of course, pulled into the combine, but a lot of times those get pulled all the way through the combine with the residue, and they get self-seeded right where you picked them up. Why we're really interested in combine cleaning is about 98% of the seeds of Palmer amaranth and water hemp are retained on the plant until we harvest them. That may not always be true because water hemp is a very quickly evolving weed. And as we change management strategies, we certainly do manipulate how it grows. But right now, if we can prevent those weed seeds from moving out of that field, we can certainly help reduce populations in the future. Combine cleaning is also really important. You buy a machine off on an auction or online or from out of state, clean the combine thoroughly before you bring it to the field, because we've seen several dozen cases where that's how water hemp's been introduced to the farm. Theoretically, is you turn the combine on the very first time from out of state in your field and you get a really nice patch of water hemp on the edge. You don't see that patch until year two or three, though, because it's only five or six plants. But each plant is producing anywhere from 20,000 to 250,000 seeds. So it's going to quickly multiply. But as far as the combine cleaning thing, I've been really lucky. Nebraska Extension had me come out and present to their producers. I spoke to about 800 soybean farmers in Nebraska about combine cleaning. We tried to avoid Big Ten sports in those conversations. The very first lunch I did, I was told, don't bring it up. I sat down, had lunch with these guys, and the very first guy said, hey, what do you think about Wisconsin versus Nebraska football and volleyball? Well, I was told to avoid those topics, so I can't comment. But the amount of producers interested, and I hope that we're making an impact really across the Midwest with our Wisconsin-based work, because it is a very minor thing. It's a tool. It's a $180 leaf blower you keep in the combine with some safety gear. Something you spend 30 minutes between fields doing. It's not going to solve your weed management problems. If you got water hemp in every field already, it's not the tool for you. But you got a few patches here and there. When we talk to producers with a little bit bigger fields, get out of the combine after you go through that patch of water hemp that those geese laid down for you. Clean out the combine right then and there. It's kind of silly to think about. From the 10,000 foot view, but when we go down in that field, we know that patch of water hemp is there. We certainly don't want to drag it through the length of that field and eventually through that entire 80 acres. So, been fun to be part of. I've gotten my work featured again across the Midwest, across the kind of the Corn Belt. It's just fun to watch how people receive it, how people laugh at it, how people think, well, we're kind of crazy, but at the end of the day, it's just about trying to have many little hammers in the toolbox.
I think that's your marketing opportunity. Like Sean has Cool Bean, I think you could be Daniel Clean for your combine and get these stickers made up that guys can put on there. We'll take a screenshot from the video of you cleaning the combine, and you could start selling those.
I certainly didn't think that I would be running a leaf blower and wearing a respirator after I gave up the landscaping. But it's been fun to do.
Well, good for you, Daniel, and us on these conversation with your Nebraska colleagues that they pretty much don't have anything to talk about. So we've pretty much handled them. So hopefully that'll continue as well.
That's right.
All right. Well, we thank you for being here, Dan, and talking about cover crops and everything today and the research that's been going on. And look forward to hearing more about the continued research. So if you want to follow Dan, he's at Agronomy Badger on X, I believe, correct?
Correct.
Best name ever.
Yep. Yes.
That is awesome. Badger. That is great that you were able to nab that one up. That is cool.
All right. Well, thanks again, Dan, for being here, and thank you guys for joining us today.
Thanks, Matt. Thanks, Dan. Appreciate it.
And so thanks for listening, and as always, happy farming.